Dan Pfeiffer was about to give up on politics when he met a man running for president named Barack Obama. He joined the 2008 presidential campaign and became one of the longest-serving advisors to President Obama, first as White House Communications Director and then as Senior Advisor. In his new book, Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter, and Trump, Pfeiffer offers a behind-the-scenes look at how the Obama White House not only interacted with media and fake news, but also met the backlash that gave rise to the Trump presidency. And Dan is in the studio with us today. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
So much insight. You have such a wealth of knowledge. How did you first get started in political campaigns? Let's start there.
Well, I went to college in Washington, D.C., and I thought my path was law school. And I wanted to take a little bit of time off before law school. There was no logic to why I wanted to go to law school. It just seemed like a thing that maybe I should do. And I went to work on Al Gore's campaign in 2000. So it was right out of college, and Al Gore lost. And I thought, well, maybe I'll try one more. And then in 2004, my candidate lost. And I didn't go to law school then either. And then 2008, I was pretty fed up with politics, and I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I was taking the GRE, taking the LSAT. I was 31 years old. I was going to be the particularly old law student.
And this was 2000 what?
2006. This is 2006. And right at that exact time, I met Barack Obama, and I had a one-hour interview with him to work on his presidential campaign. I'd never met him before. I had just read one of his books before I did it. I'd heard the hype, but I hadn't met the man yet. And he offered me a job in that meeting. I accepted without knowing what I was going to get paid, exactly what my title was going to be, and when I was going to have to move to Chicago to work on his campaign.
So you were going to go to law school, didn't end up going that way, and then you got a job. Can I ask how much you were making? Were you making peanuts?
I mean, I did okay, but I certainly had a mortgage in Washington, D.C. and a rent in Chicago, and so I did. It was a net loser economically for me in the end, in the short term, but it was experience of a lifetime, something I'd never pass up again.
I can only imagine. Now, you were slow to jump on the Obama bandwagon. Why?
I think I had, and I talk about this in the book, I had outdated views of what worked in politics. I was wrestling with this sort of conventional wisdom that talked about what the ideal presidential candidate was like, what kind of politics works. It was this older 90s style, more centrist Democratic view of what works. It sort of was all throughout the party, particularly after George Bush won two elections. And when I met Obama, I was starting to realize that did not, we've been doing this for a long time. I've been in politics for about 10 years at that point, and we had kept losing. And so I started to grow some frustration with the current sort of conventional wisdom in the party. And Obama offered a different path. And when I saw that, and when I saw the man, and I got to meet him and saw that he was a real person, that he was as inspirational as I had hoped he was going to be, I decided to make this choice.
And you moved to Chicago. The whole team moved to Chicago.
We all moved to Chicago.
So, you know, how did you get recruited to the campaign? How did you get that meeting?
So I worked for Senator Tom Daschle, who was a Senate minority leader from South Dakota. I had worked for him on his campaign in 2004. We lost. And after Daschle lost, Barack Obama hired as his chief of staff a guy named Pete Rouse, who had been Daschle's chief of staff for 20 years. He was such a prominent figure in Washington, they called him the 101st Senator. And it said a lot to me that Pete Rouse, who could have done anything in the world, decided to go from working for the most powerful senator to the most junior senator. And so, and Pete had been telling me, Obama's the real deal. You should come meet this Obama guy. And I already had another job. There wasn't like a job for me to have there until he ran for president. And so Pete, when I found myself surprisingly unemployed when the senator I was working for decided not to run for president in 2006.
You'd just been having a lot of bad luck.
I had been left at the altar many times. And Pete called me and said, you should come meet with Obama. I think he's going to run. And I was pretty skeptical because Pete and I had the same dance with previous presidential candidates. And Pete's the one who got me in the door. So I was thankful to Tom Daschle, thankful to Pete Rouse that I got to meet Barack Obama.
The 2008 campaign team was different than any you had been a part of. You write, most people think that the motto of the 2008 campaign was Yes, We Can, but it was actually WTF. We all know what that means. So what did you mean by this WTF? Like, what's the bigger meaning?
What that meant was, it's worth looking, going back and thinking, right now it seems like Barack Obama was going to win. But no, at the time, most people thought we had no chance. And so we were unafraid to lose. And so what that meant was we were willing to take big risks because a conventional standard, what every campaign does, would not work for us. And so we were gamblers, and we were not, maybe it's because we were working in Chicago, maybe it's because we were sort of removed from sort of the DC chattering class, but we took big risks. We were willing to say WTF and gamble in ways I'd never seen politicians do before. We weren't imbued with this risk aversion that is so fatal to Democratic candidates. One of the things I argue in the book that we have, that if Democrats want to win again, they have to embrace that level of audacity in their campaigning.
In a lot of ways, you changed the game, that whole campaign, and we see a little bit of that during the Trump presidency, and certainly during his campaign. Now, if you were just joining us, I'm Duarte Geraldino, and I'm speaking with former senior advisor to President Obama, Dan Pfeiffer, about his new book, Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter, and Trump. So, you know, there were main tenets of the campaign team. What were they?
Well, we took several things very seriously. I think enough campaigns don't. The most important one was building a culture. And what that meant is that we were going to build a culture that didn't leak, that was loyal to each other, where you put the campaign first. You had to be all in or all out. That's what moving to Chicago was. It didn't matter how talented you were, how prestigious you were. If you were not willing, there were no different rules for you, whether you're the campaign manager or the field organizer. You moved to Chicago, you didn't make any more, penny more than the person at the same level as you. You didn't get to work from DC 3 days a week and Chicago 2 days a week. Every single person, including David Plouffe, our campaign manager, had to take the L to O'Hare for trips. We shared rooms. And so we put this sort of lateral, trustworthy campaign. And what we valued most was having good people. That's what Obama wanted. He was referred to by people as no drama Obama. And that's his personality, and he wanted that in his campaign team, people who liked each other and were there for the right reasons. And so it's the sports team equivalent would be the most talented player may not be the best person for our team. We want the person who fits with our culture the best. And I think that's a lesson that should be used in all campaigns going forward, but in every organization, whether it's a White House, a company, your youth soccer team, whatever it is, I think there's some lessons to be learned there.
So listening to you talk, I can't help but think that there may be people who were really talented that the campaign rejected for that reason.
Yeah.
Any names you want to draw?
I would not do that. Those people know who they are. They're still mad about it.
All right, so, you know, the press spoke about the Obama campaign as being virtually leak-free. Now, you write that the press twisted this into something more sinister than it was.
I think there's two separate debates, right? There is a very legitimate and fair critique of efforts that were made by the Justice Department to prosecute leaks and targeting of reporters and things that many of us were uncomfortable with. Many of them were the continuation of investigations began under Bush. What I talk about in the book are the sort of everyday leaks that you see like every minute in the Trump administration, where it is an individual staff member who is deciding to put themselves ahead of the enterprise because they want to show off to a reporter and say, let me tell the story about when I was advising the president on this thing or when I was in this important meeting. And those are the leaks that we hated. So I separate that from whistleblowers and you know, other legitimate critiques. So the sort of, those are the leaks that bedevil this Trump administration are the ones we tried so hard to avoid because working in the White House is hard. And you need everyone trusting each other. If you don't trust the person in the foxhole next to you, you're gonna be in big trouble because you got people coming at you from every direction. And so all of that flows from the sort of culture that I talk about in the book that was critical to the 2008 campaign, and President Obama continued through all 8 years of his White House.
Did you know it would be like this before you got to the White House, or was it all a surprise?
Everything in the White House was a surprise. I'd seen the West Wing. I had been inside the actual building of the West Wing three times in my life before I walked in there the day after the inauguration to take my job. And you get there, President Obama gets sworn in, the staff gets on a bus, they drive you to the White House, they drop you off, you wander the halls looking for an office with a post-it note with your name on it, you sit down, the next time the phone rings, whether it's a reporter calling to ask a question, or a hurricane hitting somewhere, or a terrorist attack, that's on you. Like, you are there, and it is a testament to our democracy that we could have this transition of power and have it be at best a speed bump going forward, because it is a wild transition.
You write that the transition of power in our country is so abrupt that it's a testimony to the strength of our institutions, that the country doesn't fall apart a few months every 4 to 8 years.
Yeah. Really, though?
Yeah, it really, I think right now we are testing these norms in our daily politics. But I think back to my time working for Al Gore. So we have this contested election decided by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court makes this decision. Al Gore concedes. And we move on. I mean, it's not the way I wanted to move on. I think there were consequences for the country, but society went on, and it is like our system up, it's being tested now, but has worked. And the specifics of the transition are also a testament to the civil servants who are there through both presidents, who stay on no matter who the president is, no matter what party, people who work in the Pentagon, in the Homeland Security Department, the National Security Council in the White House, who keep the trains running on time as the rest of us are figuring out where the bathroom and the coffee is.
So speaking of figuring out where the bathroom and the coffee is, as White House Communications Director from 2009 to 2013, was it what you had imagined? And if you would give us sort of a rundown of your day, what would it involve?
I'll do the quick rundown of the day because I don't know what I imagined. It was harder than I thought. The pressure was greater than I imagined. The joys of the job were greater. The day was such that, I woke up way too early for what was good for my health, as I talk about later in the book, but I would get up around 4:45 in the morning. Mm. I would read what was in the papers, on email, obviously, on the internet. I would start emailing with reporters about what was in there, responding to stories. I would take phone calls. I'd take a shower. Around like 6, I would start getting phone calls from White House correspondents who were about to go on the morning shows, so they could they had questions, check in, get to the White House by 6:30, eat breakfast, get through my inbox, first meeting at 7:30 in the morning, be in meetings all day long. You were lucky if you got 15 minutes to eat at your desk for lunch. Last meeting would end 7:30. Be in the office till, 8:30, 9, sometimes, particularly in the early days before we sort of had a real battle rhythm of how to do the job. Get home, eat an unhealthy, too late dinner, usually take out, and then 9 o'clock, the Washington Post and New York Times would go online, read those stories, start responding to them, go to bed, rinse, repeat, start all over again.
So you would go to bed by what, 10 o'clock?
No, I'd probably be in bed 11:30 to midnight. I'd try to watch a TV show or something to clear the brain.
How many hours of sleep were you getting?
4.5, 5.5. I mean, it's brutal. I could not do it now. I have a 1-month-old daughter at home, so I'm revisiting that very brief, thank you, sleeping experience. But that was a young man's game, and I've discovered that I don't have that sort of stamina anymore.
So do you hate press conferences now?
Well, we don't have them anymore, so it's hard to say. I argue in the book that I talk in the book about how I hated press conferences. I found them to be, while an important part of democracy, to not be the best way for the president to get their message out. I thought there shouldn't be. I argued against a lot of them. I do think President Trump doing 2 press conferences in 1 calendar year is taking that to a tremendous extreme that I would not support. But you see, but they were always very, they were very troubling to me. I could never sit in the room for them because I'd get so worked up and I'd start pacing. So I would have to watch them in my office so I could yell at the TV like Trump, like Trump does.
But they didn't parody you on Saturday Night Live or anything.
No. I was, we were not that famous, less infamous as these Trump folks are.
Oh, and on that note, we're going to take a quick break. I'm Duarte Geraldino, and I'm speaking with former senior advisor to President Obama, Dan Pfeiffer, about his new book, Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter, and Trump. And I'm Duarte Geraldino. I'm speaking with Dan Pfeiffer. He's the former senior advisor to President Obama about his new book, Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Trump, Twitter, and all that jazz. So, Dan, over the course of Obama's presidency, the media landscape shifted dramatically. What was it like having digital outlets like BuzzFeed and Vice in the briefing room?
What really changed is what the idea of the media is. The media used to mean, like as political operatives like myself would think about it, it's the television correspondents for ABC and CNN. It's radio like NPR and then the New York Times. And it was putatively objective journalists from a handful of outlets who either covered their community, the state, or the country. And there was a battle rhythm for how you dealt with that. And then that changed so quickly to it meant everything. It meant, as you say, digital outlets like BuzzFeed or Vice who just had a very different approach. They had a different distribution mechanism for their information. They're operating on a different timeline. And then you had these partisan outlets, particularly on the right, that built up, whether it's Breitbart or Free Beacon or now Sinclair TV, who were operating within the White House briefing room essentially as if we invited the Republican National Committee in to come question our reporters. And so I talk in the book a lot about how the media has changed and with lessons for Democrats about how to think about that. But one lesson for me personally is I used to rail against the quote unquote media. Like, why can't the media do this right? Why is this the media's fault? But that's the wrong way to look at it because it's too broad a brush. The media can mean the New York Times. It could mean Breitbart. It could mean our podcast, Pod Save America. And so you have to be much more specific about what your complaint is. And your strategy has to be much more broad-based to include everyone. Because if you just did the traditional stuff, you're going to miss huge parts of the population, particularly young people. If you just do the new stuff, like the new outlets, the new podcasts, YouTube, Facebook, et cetera, you're going to miss a whole huge part of the population. So I would describe our strategy, and this is even more important for Democrats going forward, as not either or, but and both.
What about TV in particular? People always talk about TV declining. Did you put as much weight in TV as the others?
It is declining. We would think about TV interviews, with the exception of like 60 Minutes interviews after big NFL games, which would generate this massive 20 million person audience, is that we would think about the TV interviews less about the audience in particular. Like we weren't just doing the Today Show to get the audience of the Today Show. We were trying to create, to make news that everyone cover and have a video clip that could potentially go viral and be spread across social media. And so TV is it's still important, particularly local television is to a lot of people who are very regular voters. But what you cared about was video. We wanted Obama on video with a short soundbite that could be shared easily. And sometimes that would be something we would record ourselves with our digital staff. And sometimes it would be something he would say, you know, to Jake Tapper on CNN or something like that.
So were you talking about a 30-second bite? Was that the idea?
It's probably more like 15 these days. That's the more, it's brief. And it was tough for Obama because Obama resists sound bites. And he is a long-form storyteller sometimes in the Twitter age. And so we would have to think about how we told the story, not just in that 15-second bite, but it through daily disciplined repetition of the story we were telling over the long arc. And our hope would always be, we're not trying to win news cycles. We're not trying to crush Wednesday, right? What we want is, over the course of time, for people to understand who Obama was, what he stood for, what he was trying to accomplish on their behalf, what his values were. And so it was this long story. And we benefited from having one of the great communicators of all time. It's a little like having Michael Jordan in your backcourt. But like we were successful in that based on his two victories. And
that's how you measure success, his two victories?
Well, I think you measure it through every course of the way. You measure about getting reelected because that's your ability to do more. Your policy success is the bills you pass. There's a lot of things we left on the table in part because we had Republicans who took over Congress. But there's no question that some group of people felt left behind enough that they either voted for Donald Trump in 2016 or, including some people who had supported Barack Obama in 2012, but more importantly to me, people who decided not to vote, who thought it didn't matter enough to vote. And that's the most devastating way to think about the election, is that there are people who were dramatically affected by the policies that are happening right now, who could have prevented this from happening, who didn't feel this political system meant enough to them to be a part of it. And that is what is so critical to a 2018-2020 message for Democrats. You got to make people feel that this vote matters more than anything else, because it does.
There's some people who say, and Obama as well, that maybe he was elected a little bit too early.
Yeah, that I tell a story in the book about him saying that. He said that exact thing to me in 2014, that maybe it was because of the circumstance of the political moment coming out of Iraq the, you know, frustration with Katrina, the corruption that was happening in Washington, the financial crisis, combined with Obama's tremendous political talent, that there was this perfect matching of the man and the moment that may have fast-forwarded something that Barack Obama and myself believe were inevitable in politics, and that there was a reaction to that moment, and that, particularly within the radicalization of the Republican Party around racial lines, it became more homogeneously white. And even though the party has a long history, you know, dating back to Nixon, of sort of a racial strategy, the Southern strategy, it oftentimes was a little more a dog whistle. But by 2016, it says a lot that by 2016, they felt comfortable putting away the dog, through Trump, putting away the dog whistle and picking up the bullhorn on these racial issues. And that is, I don't think that Obama didn't create Trump, Obama's voters didn't create Trump, his policies didn't create Trump, but this moment, it's hard not to see some measure of what has happened to the Republican Party itself as a reaction to Obama. I say Barack Obama drove the Republicans crazy.
Barack Obama drove the Republicans crazy. You know, during his first term, it seemed like he didn't speak about race enough, especially given the current political environment and Trump, where we have all these dog whistles. Did you talk with President Obama about race?
Of course. And he, you know, and I got to like hear him talk about it privately and publicly. You know, so going back to 2008 campaign, when he gave his famous speech, speech on race in Philadelphia in response to a controversy around his former minister. You know, whether it was his response to the Trayvon Martin shooting, to Ferguson. And it's always a balance, because race and politics is such a tinderbox in a really tough way. And Obama had felt he had to pick his, he's talked about this himself publicly, that he should pick his moments about when the right time was, because what you don't want to have everything he say have immediately polarized. If he's the spokesperson on something at a certain moment, you have an immediate polarization, or the Republicans feel a need to immediately respond to him negatively. And so there are moments where he felt like he absolutely had to speak out, and did. He did it some more as time went on. But sometimes in our hothouse political climate, like in a world of Twitter and cable news and Fox, that maybe Obama's not the best spokesperson in that moment. Maybe someone else is. And so he picked his moments. I think he spoke with great eloquence when he did. And I was honored to be in the room sometimes when he would make those statements.
What were the quiet conversations like? The ones that were not made public.
Well, I
in
think
tone and
the thing is, there is one Obama. There's the guy I met in 2008 is the guy that I saw late last year in D.C. the last time. The idea of the Key and Peele anger translator is not a real thing. Like, I mean, I'm sure sometimes he is angry, but like what he would say in private is not different what he said in public. I think if you go back and look either at the speech he gave on race relations 2008, or you know, the really powerful statement he gave in the briefing room about Trayvon Martin, he's giving you a full view into how he thinks about these issues. He's not saying anything differently to me than he is in that room that day.
Do you trace the birth of fake news to the birther movement?
I think the birther movement was the sign that this conspiracy theory, we've always had conspiracy theories in this country, but that the birther movement was when it became sort of weaponized in politics and moved to the forefront. It sort of moved from the dark corners of the internet to the mainstream of the Republican Party.
So you're talking about the weaponization of information or news or propaganda?
All of the above. I think what happens is, I think that there's always been this strain of conspiracy theories in this country, JFK, moon landing, some very even kookier ones than that, which are pretty kooky. But now the internet, And then social media, Facebook in particular, make it much easier to spread it like wildfire. It's not just water cooler chatter anymore. People are sending it with the push of a button en masse to lots of people, and frankly, a large portion of our populace are not particularly schooled at discerning real from fake news, because they grew up in a world where real news, there was no such thing as fake news. Real news was something that came from news outlets, and now the fact that it's these things that are putatively news outlets but are really propaganda organs is not it's not proof that they are real. It could just as easily be fake. And you know, people are scrolling through Facebook on their phone and they're seeing these headlines and not even clicking on it. So they believe it. And we confronted this full bore when Donald Trump, back when he was just a reality TV star, decided to make it a cause celeb to draw attention to this fake conspiracy theory that I'm not sure he's abandoned to this day.
Was there a lot of disagreement within your team about whether you should devote energy and resources to refuting the claim that President Obama was not born in the USA?
Well, there was disagreement. There was everyone else, and there was Barack Obama, who believed that he was the one who told us to put the birth certificate out. I thought at the time it was a terrible idea. I was not angry about it, but I just hated the idea that we would be forced to do something by Donald Trump in his band of kooks who believe this.
Wow, and a band of kooks. You went that far.
I went that far. And by the kooks, I mean the birthers. Like, that is a kooky conspiracy theory. We had already put out one birth certificate, and then they had reconcocted a conspiracy theory to believe that birth certificate was not real, and they needed the short-form certificate was not real. They needed the long-form certificate. It was so crazy. And so I did not want to give them that, you know, that satisfaction to put it out. And Obama, and I tell the story in great detail in the book, Obama wanted to do it. In fact, he was digging around. He was at home in Chicago, spending the night there, and he was digging around in a box looking for something. And he found what he thought was his birth certificate and brought it back to the White House and was like, let's put this out. And then our White House counsel looked at it and said, that's not your birth certificate. That's the one you buy in the gift your mom buys in the gift shop in the office that you frame, at the hospital that you frame. But then he sent him off to get the birth certificate. And what he wanted to do was put it out, but make a point about the trivial nature of our politics. And he did. And my take now, looking back on it, is not only was he right, but that we should have done it sooner. Like, the lesson for Democrats I talk about in the book is, you, in the world, in the age of the internet and social media, you have to respond immediately with disproportionate force to these sorts of things right away, because if you don't, they're going to take hold. To this day, large numbers of Republicans still believe the birth certificate is fake.
So what would have been disproportionate force?
I think in the campaign, or in the early days of the White House, we would have done exactly what we did in 2011 and put it out. We would have put it on the website. We would have used Obama's, you know, millions of person email list to send it to everyone. We would encourage, take all of our millions of volunteers, have them share it with all of their friends. We need to turn, and this is how I think Democrats are going to fight back against fake news in 2018, 2020, is we have to arm our supporters to not just knock doors and make phone calls, that's important, but also to become ambassadors for the truth and essentially rapid response organs, to use their social platforms to communicate with their networks, both online and offline, to push back against this fake news. If you're a Democratic supporter in 2020 and you're looking at Facebook and you see some fake news conspiracy, the equivalent of the stories that were like Pope endorses Trump or Hillary.
But you have to recognize it first.
That's going to be on the politicians and the candidates to have mechanisms to communicate with our supporters, our volunteers, who will trust information from the campaign, and then use and then send them out there to communicate with their networks about it. Like, you have to do we have to look under every rock, find every conspiracy theory, and respond to them before they take hold. And that did not happen in 2016. We did not know how powerful some of this stuff was. And now, of course, you had the Russians weaponizing this with bots and a whole bunch of other things, but it's still a real strain in our politics. It's one that Trump is himself using his Twitter account in his White House to propel. And so we're going to have to use every tool available to us. Some of those tools that we'll use in 2020 have not even been invented yet, but
Say that one more time. Some of the tools that we're going to be seeing have not even been invented
yet. Yes. Well, think about this. There is a technology that is still in its early stages. This is one of the most worrisome things about politics, where it can take video of anyone and then basically use their previous video of them to have them saying anything. So you could see video of President Obama endorsing Trump. It'd be a fake video, but it seems real. You could have that of Secretary Clinton. And so the challenges we have are only going to get worse. And so my hope is also that technologies will have more tools at our disposal to fight back against this as well, because the technology and politics changed so fast. In 2008, in 2007, when I started working for Barack Obama, think about this. Facebook was really only used by college students. Twitter was in its infancy. Instagram, Snapchat, not invented. The iPhone was not invented. The idea that you could watch the news or listen to the radio on your phone was crazy to people. And so think about where we're going to be 3 years from now. There's going to be more things at our disposal. And so we're going to have to always be not just at the curve, but a little bit ahead of the curve as Democrats thinking about how to communicate, because we have fallen behind to the Republicans because they have built up this massive online propaganda machine that is shaping the conversation around politics.
Earlier, you said that there was this amazing sort of constellation of events that led to President mm-hmm. Obama. In some ways, one could argue that he then leads to President Trump. Do you have hope for the country, given what you've seen, where we are, and all this emergent technology? Briefly, because our time is almost running out.
I called the book Yes, We Still Can for a reason, because I am hopeful that the Trump presidency is a speed bump on the path to an America that looks a lot more like the thoughtful, inclusive, uniting politics of Obama.
And do you think that there is, in fact, a left-wing propaganda machine?
We don't want a propaganda machine. We want a left-wing, we want a progressive media infrastructure that is fact-based, inspirational, and unifying, with the exact opposite of what the Republicans have.
Thank you so much for joining me right now. Excellent work. Fascinating book.
Thank you for having me. This was a blast.
And I'm Duarte Geraldino, and I've been speaking with Dan Pfeiffer. He is the former senior advisor to President Obama, and he has a new book out, Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter, and Trump.